Welcome back to Following Know It on a Stormlight podcast. This week is our Wind and Truth preview week 13. I'm losing track now. I think it's 13. Tim, how are you?
I'm doing all right today. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. David, how are you?
Some challenges recently with having a newborn, but otherwise I'm good and excited about these chapters, although they did not contain what I thought they would.
Yes, they did not contain what I also thought they would, but they did contain the Way of Kings. So let's roll intro, and we will read more parables or more excerpts from the fourth parable of the Way of Kings. All right, I will go ahead and read them. The Almighty has given us the limbs to move and the minds to decide. Let no monarch take away what was divinely granted. The heralds also taught that all should have the sacred right of freedom of movement to escape a bad situation, or simply to seek a brighter dawn. I continued on my way, contemplating dust and the nature of desertion. For I, as king, had walked away from my duties, and I was different, and it was different for me. Had I not renounced a throne the Almighty had granted, and in so doing undermined my very own words? Was I abandoning that which was divinely given to me?
I think this is an interesting callback, actually, because in Rhythm of War, there's a scene where Dalinar connects with Nail and gets flashes of Nail's past. And this particular one, Nail standing with a group of scholars and unrolling a large writ filled with writing. The law cannot be moral, Nail said to them, but you can be moral as you create laws. Ever must you protect the weakest, those most likely to be taken advantage of. Institute a right of movement, so that a family who feels their lord is unrighteous can leave his area, then tie a lord's authority to the people who follow him.
Interesting. I forgot that existed.
I'm glad you brought that up.
Did you remember that? Or did...
Not only did I remember it, it was highlighted in my Kindle.
Oh.
Because it feels like it was part of my whole research and theory crafting into the Herald's madness.
Okay.
Because this is really good evidence of how Nail used to behave prior to the madness. And it's, you know, he seemed like a good guy, right?
Yeah.
And you know, talking about how the law can't be moral, but you can be moral while creating laws, like, that doesn't sound like something Nail would say in modern, you know, modern times with his insanity. So.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely the opposite of how he is now.
I think that what when it says the heralds taught that all should have the sacred right of freedom of movement, I think he's talking about Nail.
I did notice the mention of the heralds, which I thought was an interesting inclusion in the Way of Kings. But maybe it's less profound than I'm thinking. But with the idea of this justice issue that you just brought up with the Nail callback, is Noadon going to, are the Knight's Radiant ideals going to stem all of them from Noadon, or like, is he going to slowly reflect each Radiant Order at least a little bit, or did the Radiant Oaths predate him?
That's a really good question. I also want to point out that Dust is literally in the name of one of the Radiant Orders that we all know almost nothing about, the Dustbringers. Yeah. Now, is it true that the Dustbringers that wanted to be called something different? Like, they don't like that name?
Because they didn't like how close it was to Voidbringers.
Right. But maybe Dustbringers is supposed to reference this passage in Way of Kings. Maybe they you know, have something to do with open borders, right to travel, you know, caring for the weakest.
Are they adjacent to Edge Dancers?
I don't remember off the top of my head.
They are.
Really? Okay.
It's Truth Watcher, Edge Dancer, Dustbringer, Skybreaker.
Which one do they they share the Slippy Slidey?
Yes. It's Edge Dancer, Dustbringer, Skybreaker. So those are the three. Interesting.
So it's also going to be close to Cultivation.
Yes, and close to Justice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cultivating Justice.
I always thought Edge Dancers were more about like compassion for other people, those who aren't seen. And Dustbringers, if anything, I would have said they're about like personal freedom.
What does the Brandon excerpt
say?
I don't remember the Dustbringer video very well. We're talking about the ones where they leading up to the Leatherbound Kickstarter.
But not only that, like, what does the quiz tell you is like your ideals? Oh. You know, like just the brief synopsis that we got a couple years ago.
Anyway. I mean, I can read the Coppermind entry on it.
Yeah, that's what I'm briefly.
Okay, this is from
Self-Mastery is their second ideal, apparently.
Yeah.
I thought that was Else Callers.
Perhaps the same idea, just brought out in a different way.
So they want to deeply understand people.
Which seems to fit.
Yeah. Also, large variety. The most variety among rating. I would think that's surprising to me because isn't there the... Which one is it that don't even want to bind with humans anymore? Benley's.
Yes, the... Oh, I don't remember what they are. She's a truth watcher, is she not?
Not a truth watcher.
A will shaper.
Yeah, the will shaper. Because we're always told the will shapers are extremely individual and diverse. The Dustbringers were more so. That's really interesting. But yeah, I feel like we may learn more about the Dustbringers in this book, given the focus on dust in these passages. A thought.
A good thought. Anything else on the Way of Kings excerpt?
Once again, he says he renounced his throne. Some more strong language. I think we'll get more on this.
Yeah, in general, it sounds like, you know, this is pretty common in our own history where kings said that they were divinely put into power. And they used that to justify being above the law. So I wonder if he's like pushing against that very concept of like, should a king be above the law?
Yeah, fair enough. Okay. We've got some ghost blood action, gentlemen. Not just a little bit, I think, actually quite a bit. We walk into the secret room, bunch of secret stuff on the shelf. They're going to sneak into the spiritual realm with Dalinar. A lot of question marks there. And then shoot the crossbow is kind of a separate thing. But they're planning on investigating Ba'edo Mishram. And then coming back at some point. Maybe hundreds of years later.
Yeah, their plan seems to be, when Dalinar enters the spiritual realm, to just sort of like hop in before the portal closes.
Yeah.
That's quite the, even the ghost bloods, like what's the word I'm looking for here?
Ambitious.
Yeah.
Optimistic. Naive.
Like in the tower.
Yeah. So I'm actually kind of curious on this whole plan. Cause they said they have a very reliable source that has informed them about Dalinar stuff. And we learn in the chapter that that's Jean Nott. And Jean Nott is like kind of working with them, but kind of not in the chapter. So now I'm wondering, is that even a viable plan? That the Ghostblood seem to think so. Is Jean Nott telling them the truth or not?
How is John not making it into the tower in the first place?
I mean, that's a good question.
It's so their plan is to hop into Shadesmar and then go to the tower in Shadesmar. And then because he's uniting all three realms from there, they can sneak in without anyone knowing.
Did they say that?
Yeah. Yeah. At some point they mentioned they're going to go into Shadesmar.
Yeah. When they're giving their presentation to their eight other guys, they say that.
Mm-hmm.
That makes more sense, although you'd think they'd have Radiant Guards in Shadesmar.
Yeah.
And it also in the chapter, it was deliberately said that Dalinar and Navani are going to go somewhere to go hop in their portal. Not in your Yurithiru, they're going to go hang out somewhere lower down, which I thought was an odd detail to include. But they're deviating from at least the top of the tower. Maybe it might be the bottom of the tower. I don't know. But yeah, we'll see how that pans out.
Yeah, it seems very convenient on Sanderson's part for it to not be deep in the tower that they have to infiltrate.
Definitely. I'm wondering, what is it with the Ghostbloods and basements?
They do like hanging out in their basements.
Especially, so I don't even mention, like, why are there basements when the high storm's going to flood it? Like,
yeah, and in both places, they found ancient places where the basements have been there for a long time. So I'm wondering, are these buildings connected somehow in some way? And that's how they were found? Or is it just they like to be in cool places?
They
found a cool place.
Basements are known to be cool.
Did the Ghostbloods know they were there before even arriving to Narok, or did they just kind of, you know, look closer than everyone else did? I don't know.
I wouldn't put it past at least Marais to just like try to choose a location that feels like gives a sense of importance or a sense of like mystique. Like, he's all about presentation and how he's perceived. And so it's like, look, I know about these ancient tunnels, right? Or something along those lines. And like, we're going to meet in those and I control them and no one else knows about them. Like, it just sort of builds the sort of, I don't know, reputation of the Ghostbloods in a sense.
I was wondering if everybody else in the room, like all the other Ghostbloods in the room, are going to be accounted for. And at the end of the book, Yatil and Marais get in over their head and they're like stuck in the spiritual realm for 300 years and come back in Mistborn Era 3. Like, what? That was not on my radar before this book, but now, like, that we're flirting with time travel to the future in the spiritual realm, or at least time locking yourself, totally feasible that they just lock themselves away for however many years trying to get out, and then they pop up in, you know, Elantris 3 or whatever.
I think it's quite possible. Like, first of all, it's a pretty big trope. Like, the villain gets stuck in the time trap or whatever it is, right? But also, like, someone's gonna have to get trapped in there for 300 years, or why would he be telling us so often that it's easy to get trapped in there for hundreds of years?
Like, it's probably not Shallan.
Yeah, I don't think it's, I don't know.
It could maybe like be Navani, maybe, but I think Dalinar is not a contender, and I don't think Shallan is a contender.
So we need a reason that Kaladin becomes head of Yurithiru.
Right.
So something happens to Dalinar, something happens to Navani. I could see that being true. Dalinar ascends to honor. Navani is stuck in the spiritual realm. Kaladin has to come back and lead
Yurithiru. There was a specific mention, which their physical bodies hang out like in the physical realm, which I thought was a very specific detail to include conveniently, because now they could go lock Navani in the basement of the tower while she's hanging out in the spiritual realm for however many years, and the tower will still work. So you have like the vault of Navani, and no one's ever allowed to touch it, and the tower is completely functional with, you know, Navani singing songs to Mishram.
So something that no one has mentioned, like Hoid hasn't mentioned, for example, is, does the body get preserved somehow? Is it frozen, or do you just die of starvation? Like,
I would assume to the body, it's instant. For whatever the cognitive or the spiritual, it happens for like a way longer amount of time perceptively than the body experiences.
I think since we're on this part of the conversation, I was going to talk about this when we covered the Dalinar Navani chapter, but Dalinar's visions that he had in Way of Kings and that he continues to go into since then, do we think that this is actually him entering the spiritual realm in a sense, but kind of guided by the Stormfather?
With the old visions, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, so like those visions, like we thought they were like constructs that Honor created.
Right.
But maybe it's more like Honor used to guide people through the spiritual realm in order to, you know, show real history. And that makes me think, okay, so the spiritual realm has branching points to the future. Like, you can see the future, but you see possibilities. Right. Is it the same backwards? Because everyone who does those visions can manipulate them and change the events. Like, we saw that a lot, especially with the one where it was like the attack on that town by the black
midnight essence
monster, midnight essences.
Yeah.
Where the outcome of that would be very different depending on who participated in that vision. And right. If that is indeed fueled by the spiritual realm, is the spiritual realm showing possibilities of the past? And the one more piece of evidence I have for that is Hoid is like, I'm going to send you back to something that I experienced, and we're going to compare notes. Why would he need to do that if you could see the exact past events in the spiritual realm?
So I have a clarifying question for you. Are you saying that you can manipulate the past for your present self, or you're just seeing a different, an alternate version of what could have been?
The latter. I don't think we're changing the past. I don't think Sanderson has changed the past in his novels. I think he's avoiding that. I think that's kind of a bit meta, but I do think that it's like you can diverge what the spiritual realm is showing you, because in order to observe the past, you have to occupy one of the roles. You have to connect yourself to someone
right
in the past. And then now you're taking control of that person, just like Dalinar's visions. And so in that sense, you can accidentally change your perception of the past and what happened. And so I think that's Hoid's concern, is like, can we even get real data about the past using this method?
Okay. I'm on board.
So he needs to try to take on the role in a genuine way, I suppose. Now, maybe that's what Navani is there for. The other question I have is, like, if he takes Navani with him, are they taking on different roles in this reenactment? And so then could, like, if Marais and Iyadl are there, could they take on roles and manipulate the situation? Show the wrong path? Like, yeah. There's a lot of weirdness that could happen. And I'm wondering if that's what we're going to get, is we're going to get, like, more Dalinar Vision-esque stuff going on.
Yeah. It is an interesting idea that do they have to take the place of someone who really did exist, like the visions, or are they just going to be hanging out as bystanders? I don't know.
Yeah, I get the feeling it's not going to be fly on the wall stuff.
Okay.
There's one more thing that at first I was like, wow, this is huge. And then I think I realized what it was. But I just wanted to point it out anyway. Hoi just like casually says, you know, we used to enter the spiritual realm via the storm, right? He said something along those lines. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I could have missed it. I was cooking while I listened to this.
Yeah. I don't remember.
So let me find the line real quick. There we go. So the divine is asking how to proceed in entering the spiritual realm. And this is what Wit says. Well, you once had to use a high storm and the storm father's powers, but you're a bondsmith now. But you're bondsmiths now. You can open a perpendicularity and push in the spiritual realm. So that one little bit, I was like, you once had to use a high storm and storm father's powers. I read that as like the general you. Like, oh, people used to just use the high storm and the storm father's powers to enter the spiritual realm. Then thinking about it more, I was like, oh, is he just talking about Dalinar's visions? Because that's exactly what, because a high storm would pass through, the storm father would send him into a vision. And I think this is Hoid implying, yes, this was you entering the spiritual realm, just in a guided way. And I think that lines up with what the Stormfather was saying earlier to Dalinar, like, look, we already did that. I showed you what needed to be shown.
Yeah.
So I just thought I'd point that out, though, because it was a really interesting line to me. Easy to miss.
Yeah, I just gathered it as you used to go into the visions with a high storm. Now you can do it pretty much whenever you want because you're a bondsmith. So.
Yeah, same here.
Well, I guess while we're talking about it, anything else with the Navani stuff and Dalinar stuff? Oh, the Vin reference.
Yes.
The Vin reference. It was a really good I was like, oh, man, I'm not even that big of a Mistborn fan, but that was really cool. Like, Hoid's just, you know, complimenting Vin however many years later.
He's like, it wasn't the right thing to do, but it...
but it was nice.
It was hard, yeah. It's interesting that he referenced the well and didn't reference her actual ascension. Because when she actually ascended, she also made the choice to just sacrifice herself again, right? In her rage because of Ellen's death.
Right.
But still, like... Yeah, and I think we want, in general, in the notes, we wanted to talk about, like, why is it hard to give up the power?
Yes, yeah. That's something I want to talk about.
Did you want to lead into that then too?
Yeah, sure. I'm thinking there's two possibilities. There's probably more, but in my head, there's either once you become a shard, you really like being a shard and you don't want to stop being a shard, or once you actually fully step into that role, mechanically, you can't go back from it. And so you're there until you die, which apparently is pretty common.
Yeah. I viewed it as now that you have stepped into it, now that you have the information you have, you will convince yourself not to give it up. And so it's a psychological thing as opposed to like a magic mechanics thing of you see however much information you have, and if you're not Vin, then you're going to convince yourself, oh, I need to be the one to hold this, or I need to be the one to act on this information that I just got. So
didn't Kelsier give it up to Vin? Or was he kind of forced to?
It was a bit of both.
Yeah.
Kelsier just didn't match with preservation.
So I probably read Secret History most recent than either one of you, but I believe it's, as he's talking to Preservation, he realizes that Vin is the hero of ages, not himself. And so then he's like, okay, we need to go preserve this power. And that's his, like, for her when she's ready. And that's his goal to start. So maybe his intentions to start changes things. I don't know.
I could see Hoid complimenting Vin and omitting Kelsier's even greater act there. Because he doesn't like Kelsier.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, Kelsier is the better example. He literally gives it up to Vin.
Yeah. I think I remember in the story, though, it was going to happen one way or the other because he wasn't compatible enough with the shard.
Yeah, it's kind of like what was happening with Rays at the end there, where the Shard just disliked Rays. Like, Shard was like, I don't want you as a vessel anymore. It was like destroying him already. And so it just took that one little extra, you know, stabby stab from Taravangian. And then Taravangian being an extremely, like, viable vessel for Odium because he was having one of his days, empathetic days, that it just sort of pushed it over the edge. And the power was like, nah. Like, so I don't think it wasn't Raze's choice, but like Raze got killed. I think the power could have protected Raze if it wanted to. I don't know. That's just kind of, I don't have any evidence for that, but it feels like that would be the case.
It's a very interesting theory, because I had something I noticed in what Wit said that tied into Taravangian. I'll start here. Dalinar would ascend, Wit said. His mind would expand to see with the eyes of deity. The shards are not omniscient. It is relatively easy to hide things from them, but they are blessed with a near infinite capacity to understand. That's exactly what Taravangian asked for. Capacity.
Asked cultivation for. Let me just highlight that real quick.
Cultivation pulled through.
Is that what, is that what she was planning?
Yeah. Did she grant him, like, so it, we never really, I don't know, has anyone talked about what exactly cultivation did to Taravangian while he was mortal to give him these, like, shifting days? Like, how do you give a human this incredibly intelligent day or this incredibly empathetic day? How do you manipulate that? And it makes me wonder if it's related to how, in general, the power expands the mind of the vessel. Because we know power can do that without ascending. Like, Vin taking the well was at best a partial ascension. It was a limited amount of power, although a lot of it, and the power, while she held it, expanded her mind. And I believe the Lord Ruler claimed that even after becoming mortal again, his mind remained somewhat expanded.
Right.
So did she do that to Taravangian? Is kind of an interesting question.
And was she using her own power, or was she somehow siphoning off bits of Odium to expand him in another way to groom him for the role?
I assumed it was her own power, but that's a good question too.
And can you, I mean, could it just be raw fortune and neither one? Because
I don't know what fortune is. I know what fortune does, but I don't know what it is still, because it doesn't seem to be investiture, right?
Although, no, that's not right. Because Odium specifically tells Taravangian, whoa, this is really impressive without fortune. Like, he specifically tells him that he doesn't have fortune at the time.
We were just told shards can be wrong and things can be hidden from them, though.
True.
So maybe there was fortune involved and cultivation found a way to hide it from Odium. Because if Odium suspected cultivation's plan, like if Raze suspected cultivation's plan to replace him with Taravangian, he would not be very happy about that, I'm sure.
Right.
So maybe cultivation was able to hide things. We know, I wanted to bring this up as well. An example of a shard getting blinded is Harmony during the events of Era 2, getting right. blinded by autonomy. So
right.
it happens. And Hoy says it's not even that hard. So, and we also have examples of like Ruin not being able to read metal, like etchings in metal. Like, there are ways to hide things from shards.
On a lighter note, the second time I read through this, when Yatil is talking to Shallan and we actually get a line of her dialogue, I didn't pay attention the first time. The second time I looked closer and it's almost exactly German. Like, the last three words I'm pretty sure are just pulled straight from German. So I'm very curious what's going on there. Is that the language of Silverlight, or
are the Malwish just speaking German?
Maybe.
I think the Malwish are very heavily based on Germanic culture.
Okay.
I always like it helps that in the audiobooks they have German accents.
They do have German accents. That is true.
So I think maybe Sanderson told him that the Malawish were German.
And the Basiners are supposed to be like French-ish, yeah. Right? But they're not that in the audiobook. But the Basin is like loosely based on French. And Malawish are loosely based on German, I guess?
I'm going to be honest. If I had to deal with a French accent for the entirety of the Mistborn trilogy in the audiobook form, I'm not sure I would have made it through it.
For Wax and Wayne.
And also for Wax and Wayne. Yeah. All seven books, audio. I wouldn't be able to handle it. So I'm glad, like the Thalens having that awful French accent that Kate Redding does. Mm-hmm. I can't handle that. Like I can't handle her Thalens.
Yeah,
I don't know. They used to have a much better accent, and then she changed it to this weird French. And I'm just like, can you please not talk like that?
I think it might actually be. This is purely speculation, but I think it might be instruction from Dragonsteel. That she's changing her voices because you're right. She has noticeably changed some of her voices from even Rhythm of War and also Oathbringer. When we really got to know those other cultures, she didn't really nail down different voices. She kind of just picked one and went. Now they're very consistent through who or what culture is talking. She'll pick a specific accent and goes. So I wonder if that's intention by Dragonsteel.
It's very possible, or maybe it's just something that she decided between books. Maybe. Like,
yeah.
She thought about it and decided, oh, I need to distinguish these cultures better. Let's pick different accents I can do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But definitely, I think, like, the Southern Skadrians having the German accent, I wonder if it's only from the audiobooks that I picked that up, or is there textual evidence that they're kind of Germanic?
This is the first textual evidence I know of. But I like the idea. Because culturally, German's very known for masks and hiding feelings, all that kind of stuff.
Also technology, engineering.
Yeah.
Large bombs.
Well, true. So are Americans. Probably way more than Germans at this point. Anyway,
back to the shelf. Let's talk about the shelf.
Yes, exactly.
All right, so we walk into the Ghostblood room, and we have the shelf, and we get the Cosmere Lovers Easter egg, like, extraordinaire, and Shallan just starts naming stuff, and you're like, all right, dial in, let's go. And she just starts naming random stuff, and you're like, oh, man, I'm going to have to go look all this up. What'd you guys get?
So I went through, and not only did I write out in our notes everything in this book, I also wrote out everything she noticed in Words of Radiance. Because I knew we'd have the question of which ones are new.
Right.
One thing that is new, I think we probably should have guessed this, but these are not Moraes' trophies. These are Eadl's trophies. And one thing I do want to bring up just in general is I think that this chapter really reinforced that Moraes is from Roshar and probably not a world hopper. He may not have ever left Roshar.
Well,
because these are Eadl's trophies, not
Moraes. I do buy into that he's probably Rosharan. I don't buy in that he's probably not been off world because he's got an AVR and he talks about going to get the AVR.
And there is a section where his washwoman gets Aether out of his clothing.
Yeah. So I would be willing to buy in that Moraes is probably Rosharan, or at least spent quite a bit of time on Roshar, but I do think he's been off-world.
Okay,
I think he could be Thalen. I could be reading too much into it, but when he's practicing with the hand ballista, he says, my father had a few when I was young.
Yeah.
Granted, it's a pretty generic type of weapon.
Yeah, and Thalens are known to be traitors, so.
Yeah.
True.
Their technology would spread, presumably. Do we want to go through, like, what do we want to do with this list I made? I mean, I can read through it.
Well,
we can talk about it, but
I'll go ahead and read through it and briefly cover what we've already seen, and then we can cover in more detail the Wind and Truth stuff, or the stuff that's new. So there's gem hearts, there's shells that Shallan say she recognizes them, or
she vaguely recognizes them, which which might mean that they're just Rasharn shells, or it might mean that they're shells and they look similar to other shells she's seen. So
okay.
I feel like that's ambiguous, but probably just Rasharn.
Okay. Tusk of a white spine, or at least what she thinks is a white spine. Eye socket similar to a Xanthid skull. A vial of pale sand. A couple of thick hairpins. A lock of golden hair. The branch of a tree with writing on it. A silver knife. An odd flower preserved in a solution. A chunk of pale pink crystal. Delicate. And all of that is in Words of Radiance. Is that correct, David?
Correct. It's just listed off in a couple paragraphs in Words of Radiance. I think that the silver knife is probably from Threnody. The odd flower is probably Tears of Egli.
Egli.
Yeah, most likely.
Now, the crystal reappears with a description in Winded Truth. A chunk of light red crystal, like pink salt, though of a deeper, more vibrant color. So a little bit more of a description. Is this an aether?
I assume it's rosite.
Yeah, rosite.
Yeah, that was my assumption as well. But it says specifically that it's really delicate. Like, it looks like it would just crumble with the touch. That doesn't sound like rosite to me.
Maybe it's unbonded rosite, like rosite that's been around for a while.
Yeah, when what's his name? Twin Soul. When it gets to the end, it crumbles. When it gets to end of life. So
I see.
Sounds like some old rosite.
Old rosite. Okay, I believe that. In Wind and Truth, we've got a silvery horn or claw from some great beast. Now, I don't know if this is what she previously thought was the tusk of a white spine, or just another trophy from killing a big beast.
Could it be a dragon horn or a dragon claw?
It could be dragon related. I'm wondering, a violent stone egg, partly crystalline, with silver swirling around its shell.
Okay.
Dragon egg?
So this is the one I keyed into most. I initially thought dragon egg, but then I actually considered even more, what if it's an Aviar egg? I don't think we've ever seen an Aviar egg, and I would assume they would look all cool and invested.
Don't they have to be born in that specific pool of investiture in order to be Aviars, though?
I think they do, yeah. But I still think it might be an Aviar egg.
Could you bring a Larkin there and have it be born in that pool of investiture, and then the Larkin would be an Aviar?
Could you give birth to your child there?
Water birth. That's a normal thing.
Yeah. go give birth in a perpendicularity. Oh man.
Maybe that's what happened to maybe that's what the horn eaters are doing, because they can like see spren and stuff.
Oh, okay.
Specific horn eaters, not all of them.
Right.
Like see into the cognitive realm more than others.
Rock gives him a title because he's like, I'm this horn eater, and everyone's like, all right, whatever.
So I wonder if they like give birth to their children in the perpendicularity.
That would be an awkward moment to step through.
You're right. It would.
Now, of course, the sand is white sand from White Sand.
Yeah.
Mentioned again, but now she knows what it's for, at least. The only other thing mentioned in Wind and Truth chapter is a fat, succulent leaf that pulsed red and seemed to radiate heat. And this is, I don't know what this is.
Neither do I.
I wonder if this is Isles. So going back to the egg, I wonder if the egg and the leaf are just like hints that, like, you know, dragons are coming. Like we'll get there, I promise. But so I wonder if both of these, purely speculation, but I wonder if both of these are hints of stuff that is soon to come, like a lot of the ether stuff was with the Seeker projects.
Yeah. I can't imagine how Eadl would have gotten dragon trophies, though, like pieces of dragons and they're young, and like
I think it's feasible as long as Silverlight's around and she's been there.
she's much more like, what are her, well, okay, we can talk about this actually. What are her powers before and what are her powers now?
Yattle.
Okay. Is she, so previous to, because we learned that Jean-Not provided Spren to Bond.
Right.
But so she's now radiant-ish in the same way that Renarin is radiant-ish. Some form of surge binding power being granted.
Side note. But
before that, what was she?
The last, just kind of an aside, the last sentence of the chapters that we get, she refers to the entire room as Radiance, which made me think that there are other people bonded to Jean and not Spren.
No, she's warning that there are Radiance.
No, doesn't she refer to the room as Radiance?
That's not how I read it.
Yeah, not how I read it. I read it as like, oh no, Radiance.
That's how Kate Redding reads it. She reads it as like, Radiance, we've been discovered.
Oh, maybe she, I don't know. In the text, the way I read it is like,
like Radiance is like an alarm.
An alarm. Like, yeah. There are Radiance here. We're discovered.
That's way more feasible, but that's not the way Kate Redding reads it.
Okay. I feel like, I don't know.
How fast were you listening to? What speed?
I mean, I was making chicken, so I was rather distracted. But I was listening to it at 1.8 or 1.0.
Based on the text, not the audiobook, the way I completely interpreted it was she sees that Shallan is there. She makes the connection that, well, if Shallan is here, maybe we've been discovered by the Radiance, right?
Okay. And you're right. I pulled up the script. That's exactly what it does look like. What you guys are saying is that Radiance is like an expletive as opposed to like a referring to someone.
Yeah, that would be kind of interesting if they were all Radiance, but I think it's definitely implied that Marais and Yaddle have become surge binders through the nail bond with a corrupted Spren each.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And those corrupted Spren are going to be used to guide them through the spiritual realm. If you remember in the blurb, we're told that Renarin joins Shallan in her journey to the spiritual realm.
Yes. On the back of the book. Yes.
So maybe they go, maybe we need a Jean-Not Spren to guide us. Doesn't Relaine go too? They're the two with the Jean-Not corrupted Spren.
Yep.
So they're like, well, we're told that that'll help. So let's bring them. Makes a whole lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
Anyway, my point is she must have been invested in some way previous to becoming a Radiant also.
Sure.
So I'm wondering, like, was she using some of the metallic arts of Scadrial or was she using something else?
Well, okay. Well, hold on. I'm not actually convinced she is, because that would imply that she could. I mean, metallic arts I would buy, but other investiture arts, I don't know if she would be, because she'd have to be connected to whatever investiture she's using.
She's a high level ghost blood.
Yeah, but can they manipulate connection at this point? That's their whole problem, is they can't. Right?
Well, we were just talking about how she may have killed dragons. So, like, I'm just trying to connect the dots here.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
well,
would she be as fearful if she just had normal non-invested skills?
She seems pretty fearful at the end of the chapter.
But fearful as in, like, people fearing her. Like, how could she be... Like, if we look at even just, like, regular members of the Ghostbloods in the Lost Metal, they all have some invested art.
Right.
Well, does Codenames Are Stupid, does she have an invested art?
She doesn't really go on their little expedition, so it's unclear.
Yeah. But they definitely have a lot of members with different invested. Like, I don't think Kelsier is super interested in uninvested members. Felt has a ton of breath. So maybe they can provide things like breath. Sorry.
No, you're good.
It's all right.
Maybe they provide invested arts to members who don't normally have them.
Yeah. The question remains to be seen how powerful. I mean, we're about to find out, I assume, in the next chapter, exactly how powerful this room of Ghostbloods is. because either there's about to be like a hostile disengagement, or there's about to be a full on fight between some Knights Radiant and the Ghostbloods. So
who's dying to Moraes' crossbow?
The Vienta.
Possibly Vienta, but he's not fourth ideal.
One of the Windrunners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I assume it'll be Windrunner A.
Yeah, the Canadian one.
Yes.
Is Shallan going to get out of there and be able to report what she heard?
Yes. Yes, because like we just talked about the back of the book there, she's got to pass on this knowledge and then bring Renarin and Relaine. So, yes, Shallan's getting out of this unscathed, but her buddies may not.
Because I was going to say, she has her armor. Will her armor die to Moraes' crossbow?
Okay, interesting. He has one anti-stormlight sphere?
That we saw. I assume, presumably, it explodes on impact.
Right.
That then brings into question, if your Spren is solid as some sort of shard gear, will it be affected by it? I think no. I think it'll be fine.
Why?
It's invested metal, isn't it?
Yeah. I guess I don't have a great argument, but it's...
I mean...
It's different.
Fenderana was stabbed in the physical realm.
Yes, but she wasn't like a blade at that time, at that
right.
moment.
Right.
And so like she's much more physical when they're a blade or spear or whatever.
But or when whatever Sylphrin is doing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I think yeah. I need to bring up our weekly sunlit question.
Naturally.
Why is there no anti-investiture at all in Sunlit?
Like, not even referenced? Or
not referenced, not used. It may as well not exist.
Right, because I could make an argument for not being around. Like, it's still super secret or whatever. But not even referenced. Yeah, I mean, that is a good point. I don't know.
Wouldn't he need to know the tones of whatever place he goes to in order to try and make that anti-investiture?
You think at least in passing he'd be like, well, anti-investiture would solve all our problems, but I can't make it, right? That would be one thing. But like, this is so far in the future. Has it been banned? Like, is it just like
the Geneva Convention of yeah. of the Cosmere?
Like, if you're found with anti-investiture, like every single great power in the Cosmere comes after you, like,
yeah.
Is it a kind of a mutually assured destruction thing? It's just a question that popped in my mind just now, and I thought, hey, we might as well reference sunlit ones.
Yeah, it could be. It could also be perhaps the trauma. He doesn't want to think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Zellian should have summoned Auxiliary as a tuning fork and figured out some anti-investiture.
Tuning fork can't do damage. That should be fine with his.
Yeah, it's completely innocent.
Yeah, I just want to tune my flute that Hoy
exactly.
gave me.
Exactly.
Ding. Yeah. Hey, a tuning fork as a weapon against the Night Brigade with their shade soldier people. That I mean, I could totally see that.
Oh, a tuning fork that emits like anti-investiture noise that kills the shades.
You smack a shade with it and it evaporates. Ding.
Since the shades are dead, they're cognitive shadows, he might be able to attack them and just in general.
Well, okay. Sunlit spoilers, but by the end of it, he's purged his torment anyway. So.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so good.
A Spren being summoned as a tuning fork will happen, I promise you, at some point.
It seems likely.
Although, would that damage the Spren? Ooh, would that damage the Spren?
Unless them being made physical is different.
Yeah. We could find out next chapter if my tuning fork theory is
feasible. That would be cool.
There is one note I still wanted to, at least one note that I think that we should cover. The Ghostbloods were briefed on the Everstorm a year before it happened.
Yes, I saw that too. But so was Renarin. So that's, I don't think that's a huge deal.
I'm wondering, like, okay, so I feel like there's a connection to Sons of Honor here. Because the Ghostbloods were kind of working with Sons of Honor back in the Gavilar prologue, kind of.
Ish.
They were sharing information-ish.
Right? They were using the Sons of Honor.
Yeah. So the Sons of Honor were the ones who were very interested in the Everstorm, if I recall.
Yes.
So, yeah, I'm just wondering if there's a relationship there. Like, they were briefed on the Everstorm. It has something to do with the Sons of Honor. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm getting this vague recollection. Wasn't there a flashback at some point where, or maybe it's this prologue where a Ghostblood is talking to maybe Gavilar or one of the Sons of Honor, saying, "Don't worry, your desolation is coming. You just don't know it yet." Do you guys remember?
Ish. Vaguely.
That doesn't spark a memory. Not for me, but...
Okay. Like, what if they knew years in advance and this was just their briefing, like, their last briefing leading up to it?
So, I want to connect this to Venli. Because Venli... The events all start when Venli is given a Void Spren. What? Ulam, right? She's given...
Yes.
A gem that contains Ulam. And she's given this by a ferrochemist.
What's her face?
Yeah.
Who with all the rings. Yeah.
I definitely would believe that the Ghostbloods have ferrochemists. I'm not so into the idea that the Sons of Honor have a ferrochemist.
Yeah, I believe that.
Or maybe the Sons of Honor think they have a ferrochemist, but it's a Ghostblood spy.
Right.
Right. And so was it the Sons of Honor or was it the Ghostbloods who kicked off all those events?
And maybe the Ghostbloods just hijacked it halfway through, you know?
Yeah. I hope we learn like more about which secret societies did what, because it's like, it feels all mixed up to me.
Yeah.
And they all have spies within each other's ranks anyway, so.
Well, and in the chapter, it says the Stormfather's been lying to us this whole time. So half of the stuff that we've been building off of, I guess, has been pulled out from under us. So
wonderful. In book 5, right? When we're supposed to be putting everything together. It's like, correct. Oh, by the way, like half the stuff you read isn't even true.
The Stormfather, like, Stormfather just told you what he wanted you to know and left out a bunch of stuff. I'm like, okay, great.
It reminds me of the Well of Ascension.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where we need to be very careful to compare the epigraphs to the text they're reading. Like, I feel like maybe the Way of Kings is the key, in a sense, in a similar way, to like understanding what actually happened compared to what we're learning from other sources.
Hmm. Do we have a copy of the Way of Kings in metal somewhere?
Kaladin has one.
He's got
not in metal, but
yeah.
I'm just saying. Kaladin has the Way of Kings on him, which is, it's kind of, and we're getting Way of Kings epigraphs, like,
which, back to Oathbringer, the Odium burns the Way of Kings in Dalinar's hand, but then Dalinar realizes that he doesn't need it because he's got the whole thing memorized, and then Dalinar then gives his copy to Kaladin. So I don't know, interesting. Okay.
Wasn't it Syl that wanted the copy of it?
Yes, you're right. Syl checked it out from the library.
That's true.
Jeannot. I want to talk about Jeannot.
Okay.
Jeannot. This kind of ties into what we were talking about earlier. Renarin knew the exact day of the Everstorm, presumably because Jeannot. So Jeannot knew the exact day of the Everstorm, which would maybe... Well, no, they talk about how Shallan introduced Jean Nott to the Ghost Bloods. Never mind. Anyway, Jean Nott and Shallan have a little sidebar conversation to the screen. And Shallan asks Jean Nott what side you're on. And Jean Nott gives the classic, I'm on nobody's side because nobody is on my side, blah, blah, blah. All I'm trying to do is preserve Roshar for my children and for your children. And that set my brain off of like, yo, Shallan's pregnant. I think Jean Nott sees that Shallan is pregnant. Shallan's pregnant.
I was thinking that Shallan maybe got pregnant from the unusual amount of sexy scenes we got earlier.
Yeah, from three episodes ago.
Yeah.
Shallan's got twins.
I would believe that Shallan's pregnant. I want to know how pregnancy works when you're a Radiant. That seems complicated. When I thought about that, my mind went into a really weird place where I was like, is Testament's bond going to transfer to Shallan's child?
Yo, and like, we actually had this conversation on the normal podcast of handing bonds off to other people because we had the whole auxiliary versus the Windrunner Spren conversation in Sunlit of like, okay, what happened to Sigzil's Spren? Could Sigzil have like passed his Spren on to someone and then picked up auxiliary? Like there's that a big whole debate of can you pass on, can Kaladin pass Syl to Oridan, for example, or you know, something like that. I think it's totally feasible. I wouldn't say why not, but yeah.
I think Ba'adam Mishram needs to return first.
Yes. Yes.
Because if you break your bond right now, you create a dead eye.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
Now, interestingly, if you die, you don't create a dead eye.
Right.
So maybe there's a way. I don't know. I don't know what the difference there is, but.
Anyway, yeah. Shallan's pregnant, confirmed by Jean Nott.
100% confirmed by Jean Nott.
Who had that on their bingo card?
The soul of their child.
Yeah. Confirmed by Jean Nott.
Yep.
Yeah, nice. So Jean Nott is another player in this game.
Yeah.
She's doing her own thing, and it's really interesting. And I feel like this is kind of related to what we talked about last week of like Honor's power going rogue.
Yeah.
Where like when the power is just around for a long time, it starts to gain sentience and then it has its own goals. Like Jean Nott is not on Odium's side and is not on Jean Nott's on Jean Nott's side and doing Jean Nott-y things. And this is an intelligent investiture, and we're warned against intelligent investiture. So
that's true.
But notably, she does call Ba'adam Mishram her sister, which I don't know if that's figurative or literal, but that would seem to imply the same side to me.
I don't think she had too much good to say about her sister.
That's true. That's true. But I'm curious if that's just a sister by circumstance or if when they were unmade, they were sisters.
Yeah. So it's interesting that like some of the unmade are intelligent and some are not. So yeah. Maybe the source of where they came from matters. Like what was unmade matters.
Interesting.
Yeah, it could be. It could also be, they are both intelligent, and two, they were working together towards the same goal for thousands of years, so become like sisters.
I just thought of the most random crazy question. Does Jean not have a vessel?
Does Jean not need a vessel? I don't know.
Sister. I don't know. Just a random thought that came to my head. Like, Like, was the thrill seeking Dalinar as a vessel?
Almost certainly.
But would we use the word vessel for that? Or was the thrill just wanted to create some sort of nail bond equivalent with Dalinar?
Right.
Or was Dalinar literally going to ascend to the thrill and the thrill would become intelligent? Like, these are questions swimming in my head at the moment.
Or are they closer to a Luel bond and they're like closer to ethers as opposed to investiture?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Luel bond. I forget exactly how Hoi compared that to the nail bond. You said they were similar but different in ways.
Yes. They the Luel bond was parasitic, whereas the Nael bond is whatever the non-parasitic one, the symbiotic. That's it.
Didn't the Luel bond specifically have to do with the Aethers wanting to gather water?
In that one specifically, yes, but there were other types, is what it said.
Interesting. I also wanted to talk about some of the Ghostbloods motivations. This, I mean, ties in pretty well with us talking about Jarma.
Yeah.
Because it's Yaddle has her own goals, Moraes has his own goals, Vidagar has his own goals, and the person
Yaddle Shallan asks Shallan about her own goals.
Yeah. So yeah. Everyone's doing their own thing together.
With no secrets. Yeah.
Yeah. Long. Throwing up quotes. And then Moraes just straight up says, well, yeah, it seems like Vidagar is breaking his rules, so I don't care. One, it was really fascinating that Yaddle saying her goals are taking Baadu Mushroom, and then possibly not necessarily this being her goal, but what Thidakar needs is a way to control the shards. So I'm assuming they're connected. I'm not sure how.
I only read this. I know you read it twice. I only read it once, so maybe I'm remembering wrong. But what I gathered was Iadol's goal is Baadu Mushroom. That's not even Kelsier's goal, Thadakar's goal. That Iadol invented this whole thing of wanting to get Baadu Mushroom, and Thadakar's like okay with it, but it wasn't his idea. And Iadol has her own goals with it. And I also caught that line. It seems like a pretty important line to catch, is she's going to utilize Baadu Mushroom to control the shards.
Yeah. Well, and
which, how?
this is all according to Moraes. This is assuming Moraes is telling the truth that they even told Thidakar. Like, right. I'm not even convinced they're informing Thidakar, because when we meet Kelsier seems pretty uninformed about all of this in the Lost Metal.
And it seemed like Felt, when we saw Felt earlier, I got the impression he was loyal to Thidakar.
Yes.
But here they're treating him like he's nothing.
Right.
So Thidakar is leader in name only to this sect of the Ghostbloods. Right. Where like they just love to invoke Thidakar's name to give themselves an air of legitimacy. But Thidakar doesn't even know about it. Right.
Well, and I
feel like that's kind of what Felt was kind of complaining about, right? Felt's like, I follow Thadakar, not you guys. So Felt's also got his own agenda, which maybe aligns actually with Thadakar's agenda. Like,
well, in the Lost Metal, Kelsier's like, the Ghostblood's whole goal is to protect Scadrial. So up until now, that was my assumption of the Ghostblood's here, but Yaddle says Thidakar's whole intention is to protect his homeworld. Me, on the other hand, okay, well, are we even Ghostbloods anymore?
Yeah. Ghostbloods in name only, Thadakar being the leader in name only. Like, it's a sect. It's a shoot-off.
Yeah, I just looked it up here. It's at the end. Yaddle says, Master Thadakar will see eventually, Yaddle said. He is smarter than you give him credit for. He works to protect his homeland above all else. But once we find Mishram for my purposes, he will see. Master Thidakar can only protect his land if the shards can be controlled. Will this fit your plans as well? So it's not something that Thidakar is necessarily looking for, but that's what she wants to do with Mishram somehow.
Right, right. And I guess this was teased in the Lost Metal, because in the epilogue in the Lost Metal, they do reference, What's-His-Face's crazy sister on Roshar. So maybe there is more schisms than I'm giving them credit for.
I think there are as many schisms as there are members.
That's fair.
There's one other thing that I think is part of this, which is what Jean-Not said. And I don't know if I can scroll through and find this, but Jean-Not essentially said, Baadu Mushroom's probably not going to align with you. She hates humans. And Yaddle's like, that's not a problem. Like, Yaddle doesn't want to ally herself with Bada Mishram. Mm. She wants to use Bada Mishram, and there seems to be a huge distinction there.
Yeah.
I don't know how that's going to happen, but she clearly knows a lot more about the Unmade than we do. And it bothers me. Or she thinks she knows.
I mean,
that's the fatal flaw.
It wasn't until this chapter that I really got the impression the Ghostbloods might be out of their depth. I've always thought the Ghostbloods knew what was really going on. They get duped by Shallan in a little mask walking around with a hood on. I feel like the Ghostbloods are putting on way more of a front than they actually know what they're doing.
Yeah, Moraes' pants were tucked into his socks.
True, true. So, which makes the entire thing comical, and you can now function.
How embarrassing. Okay, now, I think...
Go ahead, Tim.
Okay. I think Shallan being able to sneak in, it lasts for less than 30 minutes. I think that makes sense. Like, they can be caught off guard, but also she was not prepared for that. And so that's fine. That makes sense. But I think in the larger sense of them trying to get into the spiritual realm and all of that stuff, they're definitely out of their depth here.
Something that came to mind earlier today for me when I was thinking about these chapters, you would think the Alethi in general, and we know the Alethi in general, had really good spies, right? We had at least Sadeus had a whole spy network, right? Really good spies. Yasna had spies too. Why aren't those spies joining the Truth Watchers and actually giving real spy expertise to them?
The Lightweavers?
The Lightweavers. Yeah, sorry. I said the wrong thing.
I think they are.
Like, Shallan shouldn't be the one going in there is kind of my point.
Fair.
They should send someone who's been a spy for years and years, or like a real one who knows what the heck they're doing.
Sure.
I don't know. It feels like Shallan's still pretending that she knows more than she does, which we talked about last week.
Yeah.
But why doesn't she have a real spy training her at this point?
Great question.
It might be related to the fact that I don't think a lot of people know that the Lightweavers are kind of just skulking around spying on things.
They're still pretty secretive.
Insular, secretive. They're almost like their own secret organization within the Radiance. Like, it took Shallan this long to even say that she infiltrated the Ghostbloods because she wanted to request Windrunner assistance. Like, that was the only reason, right? That she even told Dalinar.
Yeah, that's the reason. And I hadn't thought of it before, but you're completely right. And I think you're spot on with the reasoning. She hasn't told anyone because she doesn't want to tell anyone.
Okay. True or yes or no? Prediction time. Shallan is about to put on her shard plate and dual wield shard blades and take down the Ghostbloods. Yes or no?
I think she is going to don her shard plate. I think that shard plate is going to get shot with an anti-light crossbow. That's kind of what I want to see.
Okay.
I don't know. Like, I like Shallan, but I want to see some anti-investiture in action by now, you know?
Yeah.
So that's my prediction. I think Shallan gets out of it, but I think that there's going to be casualties among the Radiants. Because of Shallan's, like, overconfidence.
Right.
Yeah, Tim? I'm with you 100%. Well, maybe 99%. I think that she's going to be wearing her armor, and her armor is going to be okay. And there's going to be some reason that it makes sense. But I don't think she can match them in martial terms. So she's going to run in there and then people are going to come in behind and they're going to win, but it's not going to be pretty. And either Moraes or Yattle or both are probably going to get out and somehow get into the spiritual realm anyway.
Yes. Because this was teased, I do think that's happening in some capacity. Maybe it's just Yatil, maybe it's just Marais, you know, maybe one of them does go down in this scene, but more likely Marais than Yatil. But yes, I do think Shallan's about to summon her armor and it's going to chop her hair off or something and it'll be funny. Anything else?
Is there going to be a struggle between Shallan and Yatil? Like Shallan, because Shallan needs to pulse her span reed.
Yes.
So I feel like there might be some level of struggle to for Shallan to be able to do that, to call in reinforcements. And we're going to learn what Yatil's surge binding abilities look like.
True. Maybe we have a Dustbringer right in front of us.
Some sort of corrupted Dustbringer. Like, because I don't think Jeannot is entirely Truth Watcher's friend.
Right.
So, you know what would be really neat is a Jeannot Bondsmith.
I don't even know where to start with that. I don't.
Same.
I don't.
Let's end that. The episode then.
Okay. Okay. No, I'm not going to end it there. I do want to talk about that just really, very briefly. I think the whole idea of seeing the future is bad in the foreign thing came from Jeannot. So seeing the future as a bondsmith, they kind of already do that. I don't know. I'll leave that alone.
We know that both Marais and Yatil have their own corrupted friends. I don't think they're bondsmiths to Jeannot. I just thought it would be funny to bring them.
Well, it was.
Anything else? Alrighty. Let's close it here, and we will reconvene next week. Thanks for joining me, Tim and David.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having us.